This week I was driving down El Camino in my car, and I have a beautiful little CD player in my car, so I put in a CD that I hadn't listened to for a while. And as the sounds of this music filled the car, I realized it was one of my mother's favorite tapes. And she listened to it over and over again. Now, many of you know that last March, about 8 months ago, my mother died at the age of 90. And as I was driving along and listening to this music that I so associate with her, I realized that recently her presence has been with me in, excuse me, an ever more vivid way. Not sad, very joyful, very wise, and that she actually makes up the fabric of my life in so many, many little ways. And I was brought back to when we used to listen to this tape. In the last years of her life, you know, she had been a dynamic woman. She had 9 children. She had a husband who was unpredictable and very exciting and challenging. She had a faith community in her parish. She was very much a part of that spiritual group. She had a neighborhood. People would come to her door. They would seek advice. They would just want to be with her. She had a great laugh. And in the last years of her life, as her body began to give way, she could no longer give expression to that natural dynamism that was so much who she was. And then her memory began to go. And it was painful at first, in that in-between time where she remembered at times and then didn't remember. And then she got into that beautiful space of she just didn't have a memory. So she was constantly in the present moment. And I would go up on a Saturday having millions of things to do, but I would be with her that day to give my sister who lived with her a break. And we would just sit around and talk and laugh. And if her energy was up, we would go out on adventures. She was always ready for the next adventure. And an adventure could be going to Golden Gate Park, sitting on a bench and watching the flowers and the bees and the children and just being in the moment. My mother loved flowers. And we knew that in the end, our biggest job with her was to create beauty around her, because she had such a spirit of refinement. And so always there were beautiful bouquets of cut flowers on the piano right in her sight. And boy, did we ever get our money's worth out of those flowers, because she never remembered that she saw them before. So you would be sitting with her and she would say, "Look at that beautiful bouquet. Isn't that gorgeous? Look how the reds show up." And we would say, "Isn't it great?" And then 10 minutes later, she said, "Have you noticed the beautiful bouquet?" It had a downside, though. One time, my sister brought a beautiful gardenia, and she put it in a glass bowl and floated it and put it on the table next to my mother. And my mother clicked into the fact that there was a bowl filled with something on the table from which she would eat. And so she ate the gardenia. I don't think she would mind me telling you that story, because she had a wonderful sense of humor. And of course, my sister had to call poison control and see if that was going to be it. But it wasn't. Gardenias are okay to eat. Not really. So as she progressed more and more towards the end, I liked being with her as much as ever, and in some ways, even more. Because as the body fell away, as the mind fell away, what was left was her soul and her soul expression. And it was so beautiful, because all of her life long, she had been a woman of prayer. I remember one time she rather mournfully said to my brother Larry, "Why am I still here? What is my purpose in this life?" And he said, "Mom," he said, "you're a flower. You're here so all of us can come and enjoy and breathe in the fragrance of your beauty." And she laughed. But he was right. He was right. That's exactly what we would do. And we would gather around, and it was generational. Not just her children, but her grandchildren and the friends and the people that she met on the street. Everywhere she went, whether she went to get her hair done or whatever it was, this soul essence came through. And I once asked her, actually it was about a year ago, I was giving a talk on this same topic. And we would talk about God a lot. And I said, "So Mom, I'm giving this talk on prayer. What do you have to tell me about it? Help me out." And she said, "You know, Helen," she said, I don't really know how to pray." She said, "All I do is talk to God." And I said, "Well, that's it. That is prayer." And she said, "Well, I'm not so sure." And I realized that because she had come from a tradition in which she was steeped in formal prayer, you know, the rosary, the Our Father, the Hail Mary, Hail Holy Queen, the Litany of the Saints, the ritual of the Mass, all of those things made up the fabric of her spirituality. And yet, even so, she found that the end result was a conversation with God. And that's what this reading is all about, really. How is it best to pray to God? And as we hear, it's really best if we can bring ourselves into an intimate relation through the heart, through devotion, through just opening up our hearts and souls to the divine as the beloved. And there are other ways, but they are fraught with pitfalls. I have a tendency to go out and buy lots of books, and my mother and father always encouraged us to do that. So years ago, I went to a used bookstore, and I picked up this gem of a volume called The History of Mysticism, Men Who Have Walked with God. And it takes us all the way from Lhotse and Buddha on to, in the 6th century BC, to William Blake in the 18th century. And as I was preparing for this talk, I picked this book up. I just wanted to hold it because it's full of very wonderful vibrations. But as I flipped it open, I flipped it open to Socrates. And I read what Sheldon Cheney, the author, had to say about him. Socrates was a beautiful soul. Many of you have read The Republic and know about his life. I have a memory that my first prefix for a phone number was Hemlock, and my father taught me to remember that by telling me the story of Socrates. And but Socrates, he was goodness, he was wisdom, he was humility. And when the people in the town voted him the wisest member in the town, he said, "Well, I suppose I am wise if what that means is that I know nothing." This author, though, says that Socrates was able, because of his brilliant intellect, to go just to the portals of the divine, and that the divine reality was on the other side, but he could never go through. And he explains it this way. He said that he was such an intellect that he could never stop questioning. And he uses this wonderful phrase, if I can remember it. He said he had the logician's unholy drag of thought. And I thought, boy, that's something to remember. Swami talks about this in The Path. He says that he went through periods of great doubt and skepticism because he had this tendency to intellectualize, to ask questions. Not that that's bad, but that the other side of it was that Master said, you need to develop devotion. And one time, one of Swami's friends in the ashram was having a difficult time, Jean Haupt. And so Swami went to Master and he said, "Master, Jean is going through a period of discouragement." And Master said, "Well, of course I knew." He said, "He's not the only one." He said, "There are many who are experiencing these doubts." He said, "Heads will roll. There will be a house cleaning." And Swami said, at that time, many left, even the little boy who had the vision of Jesus. And he said, this happens sometimes in the final years of a great master, that there's a house cleaning that leaves behind only those who have that clarity of heart and thought together. so that there is a devotion and a loyalty and a wisdom that can carry on the work. And I thought, oh, that's really good to remember. And how do you do that? Well, our reading this morning says to us, Jesus brought us the Our Father, and we have this sense of God as the eternal provider. Give us this day our daily bread. And as the unconditional lover, forgive us as we have forgiven others. And we have this vision of Krishna, who brings us Divine Mother, and also a sense of the Beloved, but a sense of God that we as human beings can cuddle up to. It's a beautiful image. We need to cuddle up to God as we cuddled up to our own mothers and our own fathers. We need to trust God with everything in our lives, unconditional openness, knowing that we will always be held gently and firmly close to his very heart. Now, unfortunately, there are those who visualize God in a different kind of way. Not too long ago, I was invited to lunch by an old college friend, a very dear friend. There were three of us, actually. We'd been roommates in college. We'd been roommates with our first jobs after college. We've always kept in touch through births and weddings and all of that. So the friendship is deep. And she sits down at the table. We could barely start eating when she says, I have to tell you something. I said, okay. She says, I have lost my faith. And I said, really? I said, where did it go? And she said, no, Helen, I have really lost my faith. And she was distraught. And as we talked, it came to me that what she had lost wasn't her faith, but she had lost the faith of her childhood that no longer was relevant, didn't stack up against her life experience, because it was a faith that was steeped in a God who was judgmental, who gave retribution for trespasses, a God who was stern. There were rules. There was not only original sin, but there was mortal sin. All of these things that would set one up for failure. And no reincarnation, the very forgiving concept that allows us to say, oh, you know, let's go as far as we can, and then we'll go farther the next time. None of that. A kind of finality to any mistakes that we might make. And with that kind of a God, she was weighing that against her life, which had at its very core a faith community rooted in friendship and love and music and song and fun and all of that, but that didn't quite stack up on the other side. And so I said to her, I said, you know, I said, there's another way to look at mortal sin. And I remembered Swami saying this to me, and then I read it in the commentaries of the Bhagavad Gita that he's just put out. And that is that any finite act could never have an infinite consequence. And when I said that to her, it was as if the lights went on. Because for those of us who are Catholics in our beginnings, and who have grown up with that kind of an orientation, this is the key. And she totally changed her tenor. She says, of course, what was I thinking? What was I thinking? And then she was able to look at God in another way, the God of the Our Father, the God that we see in Krishna's life. And later on, I think this is one of the best gifts I've ever had. As we said goodbye, she said to me, Helen, could you teach me how to meditate? And I thought, oh, a big step has been taken here. And what a great blessing to be a small part of that. But all in how we come to the divine. Now, if we look upon the divine as an I-thou relationship, and we seek it out through intimacy, then we also have to understand, and Swami says this, that God is the quintessential unrequited lover. Think of that. He longs for us. He waits for us. And we turn away. And I remember another little volume that I had, this time the one that my father gave me, because he loved it. It's called The Hound of Heaven by Francis Thompson. I'm sure you know it. And I read it. It's a great long allegory of the soul. And in one part of it, you see, the poet says he was running through these streets and there was a shadow that was coming over him and he was terrified in his soul, only at the end to find out that it was the shadow of the hand of God extended in help, in love, in blessing. And how often do we play that out in our lives because we revert to another version of God, not the unconditional love version? How often do we do that? I do it. I feel one time, Swami had scolded me. And even though I had had the best of intentions, I had really, really flubbed up. And he scolded me and I had taken it so to heart, I was just devastated. And there was a work day at the Expanding Light. This is when I lived at the Village. And so we were all out there cleaning up the manzanita in anticipation of the fire season. And as the custom was at lunchtime before we all gathered to eat, we had a meditation. So we went into the temple, this beautiful temple with great vibrations. And because I was feeling so terrible, I took myself away from the group and sat in the very, very back. Just at the time when I needed their support. It was my decision. And then in through the door, much to everybody's surprise, comes Swami. And I thought, oh no. And where does he sit? Right next to me. Forcing me to open up my heart, to accept this unconditional love that I have never not seen him give. Even at the moment of scolding, underneath all of the words, I could hear, I could feel his love. And that's what God is. That's how we want to be with each other, with ourselves, with our nearest and dearest, and even with those who aren't near and dear. When I think of my mother, I also think of the fact that with 9 children, she didn't have a whole lot of time for prayer. And there was a prayer that was framed on the wall up near her dressing area. And it was the prayer of the pots and pans. And I think that kind of sums up how she went about her life in a kitchen, in the with the laundry. I mean, she was a traditional stay-at-home mother. And I came to a deeper understanding, I think, of what that means when I came across a little tiny book at a sale at City Library in Chico one year, and it was 25 cents. Now, I couldn't imagine why anybody would give this book away. It was all inscribed in notes and underlined. Once I read it, and I thought, maybe the person who owned this book died because I will never give this book away. And it was called Practicing the Presence of God. What's the subtitle? The Best Way, The Best Rules for a Holy Life. And it's the story of Brother Lawrence. And Brother Lawrence was just this humble monk who came to the spiritual life late. He was 55 when he entered the monastery near Paris or in Paris, and 17th century. And he didn't come in as at the top of the hierarchy. You know, in a monastery, there are the brothers who say Mass. They're educated. They understand theology. They say Mass. And then there are the lay brothers, and those are the brothers who do the menial work. They are in the kitchen, they scrub the floors, they do the shopping, but they don't say Mass. He was a lay brother, and he describes it. There's very little that is left from him, but there are a few letters. And he describes it this way. He says, at first I would go into chapel, and I would do the devotions, meaning the prescribed prayers. And he said, and I would think about death and judgment and heaven and hell and my sins. And he said, and then when I wasn't in chapel with the other monks praying, I would be, his job was in the kitchen for a long time. I would be in the kitchen. I'd be doing my other work. Then he said, I schooled myself to be in the presence of God and to feel his presence in every moment. And he said, after a while, just a few years, he said, eventually it came to be that there was no difference between my time in the chapel and my time in the kitchen. And he said, I always, no matter what, felt the joy and the elation of the consciousness of God within and around me. And I thought, isn't that what we have to do? In every nook and cranny of our lives, around every corner, coming up over every hill, in every cupboard, in the kitchen, in the office, in the classroom, in the coffee shop, in the car. And the litany goes on. We have to do what Brother Lawrence did with all of the forces of our will, with all of our heart. And then our beloved will come to us in the sweetest, the most beautiful divine romance. And then if we lose our memories, it won't make any difference.